Welcome to the UGABCM podcast. This podcast is a ministry of the UGABCM right on campus in Athens, Georgia. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoy.
All right. I'm so glad to be here with you. It is such a privilege and honor to travel and to share not really even my story, but God's story that He's written through my life. And I just want to jump right into it and share some of my story and share even more on the other side of what God has done. But my name is Joshua Broom. I live in Dallas, Texas, and my life has been transformed by the person of Jesus Christ, but applying the Bible to my life changed everything about my life. But long ago, when I was a kid, that wasn't the case. So I grew up in a small town in Pageland, South Carolina. So super small town, pretty close to Charlotte, North Carolina. And I grew up not having a dad. And not having a dad in today's culture is unfortunately not an uncommon thing. And what was unique about my upbringing was that the father that I didn't have in my life, he was just down the street. And that father that I didn't have that was right down the street, he had gotten married 2 years after I was born, and then all of a sudden I watched before my eyes the thing that I wanted and needed be a father to two other kids. And while my mom and I were struggling, I didn't have what I wanted and needed, but it was right there. And sometimes it can just be so apparent in your life. It's like, well, if I had what I needed, I wouldn't feel the way I do, and I thought that I could fix myself. And there's many times in your life where you can feel isolated, and solitude's not a bad thing, but isolation is. And this is the way that I describe it. So isolation is being alone. Solitude is being alone with God. And when you find yourself being alone because you're running from something, that's not a good place to be. But if you seek to God for solitude and rest and preparedness, that's a good way to live. But most of us find ourselves in isolation because something drove us there. And that was my story for most of my life. My identity was based on what I didn't have. So I thought, well, I need to prove to myself and to the world that I'm worth something. And I tried to be the best student, because if I was a good student, I would hear good job. And I would feel the affirmation that comes with making good grades. And I thought that that would medicate the wound that I had in my heart. And for a moment, it would work, but then it would make me feel empty soon after I got the grade. And then I tried to become the best athlete. And I did, but the affirmation only lasted so long, and that just was a continuous cycle through my life. I was trying to be the best in whatever I was doing, and doing a good thing for the wrong reason is not a good thing. And there's many things that God has given you regarding your personality, your abilities, moving in the right direction towards God to honor Him. Those things are great, but if you misuse them, or you try to seek finding affirmation or approval on your own by using those things, it leads to pain, it leads to frustration, it leads to loneliness. And that was my story. No matter what I did, no matter how good I was, I still felt rejected and alone. And I started modeling and acting, and that was my next thing, where if I would do well, I would feel good, until the job was over or whatever it was. And that continued in college. I studied theater and I just wanted to be the best. And eventually I moved to Hollywood. And when I was in Hollywood, I was acting, I was modeling, I was doing all this stuff, but I was trying so hard not even to be successful, because I couldn't enjoy my success because I was measuring how successful I was based on the people around me. And how often do we look to our left and our right and we don't even enjoy today because we're worried about how we measure up? How many times do we look to social media to see what does someone have? Do they look a certain way and they look, if I had what they have or look like how they look like or do what they do, maybe I'll find the satisfaction that they have because they look happy. But it's just on the surface. Like Instagram, TikTok, all the things, it's a highlight reel. There's filters and fake things that make things look different than how they actually are. And so many times we pretend to be okay when we're not. And we're just managing how people perceive us, and we don't even address the problems that we have in our own life or our own heart. We're so worried about what strangers think of us, we don't even address how we think of us. And it leads to so much brokenness. And that was the cycle that I was stuck in. And while I was in Hollywood, I thought, well, okay, I'm going to make it. I'm going to get my big break. And these three girls walked up to me and they said, hey, do you want to be an actor? And I thought they were asking me, you know, that because maybe they wanted to invite me to be a part of a project they were working on, or maybe they were going to invite me to meet a casting director or something like that. But they weren't talking about that at all. They were talking about pornography. They were asking me, did I want to be in the pornography industry? And they asked if I wanted to meet with their agent. And I had seen pornography for the first time when I was 13 years old. And I didn't have an example of a mom or dad at home. So I didn't have an example of what did a healthy relationship look like? What did love between a man and woman look like? I was being educated by the world. Romans 12:2 talks about that, where you're either being conformed by the world or you're being transformed by the renewing of your mind. And that's important because it talks about, so it allows you to discern what is God's good, pleasing, and perfect will. There's a line in the sand. There's truth and there's lies. There's good and there's bad. There's evil in this world. And if we allow the world to educate how we see and what we think, it'll do exactly that. And if we're not told truth, if we don't come into the understanding of truth, we will believe a lie. And if you believe a lie to be true, it becomes true to you. And through that lens, you see the world. So if you see through a broken lens, you're probably going to live a broken life. And I heard, hey, do you want to do porn? And I was like, I don't, but I'm curious enough because I've seen it before and I lived a very promiscuous lifestyle. Maybe I'll just see what the agent has to say. And I meet with this agent and he says, I want to ask you three questions. How did you grow up? Why are you in LA? And what do you hope to accomplish? And I said, well, I come from a broken home. I come from, you know, I said that just, you know, me and my mom, pretty much. That's how I grew up. And if someone's asking those questions in order for them to manipulate you, they're like, okay, I've got something to work with. And then I'm like, okay, I'm in LA, I'm trying to act and model. A lot of people are in a place like that trying to accomplish something in the creative space. And then he asked me, well, what do you hope to accomplish? And I said, I guess I want to be famous. And it's so interesting that I said that. And just thinking about what it means to desire to be famous, or what it means to desire to be rich. Because anything that's not measurable is not truly attainable. Because if I wanted to be famous, okay, how many people needed to know my name to equate to me being famous? How many movies would I need to do? How many followers would I need to have? What would I need to have so that I would reach the status that I had created? It's so vague. And when it's vague, even when you say, okay, if I have this, I'll feel this, and it doesn't work, you just reach for more, but you're just grasping at air. You're grasping at vapor. It's not real. In the same way, like desiring to be rich is like that. Because if you believe that there's something external that's going to fix something internal, it's not going to work. You need heart surgery. And only Jesus can do that. But again, if you believe a lie to be true, it's true to you. And I was out seeking to be famous, and he gave me everything that he said that he would give me. I became famous. I made a lot of money. I did a lot of stuff. And I thought, well, if I become the most successful person in this industry, if I make millions of dollars, if I do all this stuff, I'll be happy. And when I did it, and I had it, and it didn't work, I was like, now what? When you have whatever it is that you think that you have, if you think that your problems are going to go away, it just doesn't work like that. If you feel like if you had the right job, the feelings of inadequacy will go away, you're wrong. If you feel like the porn addiction would go away when I got married, you're wrong. If you feel like the problems that I have, the anxiety I have around money, if I had enough of it, I wouldn't feel that way, you're wrong. Because there's an issue broken within you, and there's no amount of things or relationship that you can obtain on your own that's going to fix this problem. It just doesn't work like that. And having a high achiever personality is a great thing under the surrender and submission of the person of Jesus. Working with excellence, having great work ethic, all those things are great. But if you believe that you can earn the approval of others to the extent where you'll feel satisfaction in your soul, there's no amount of good jobs or likes or followers that are going to make your heart satisfied. There's no job, there's no amount of money that's going to fix your heart. I found that out. And then when everything didn't work, I made a plan to harm myself. Because I thought, well, if everything that I thought was going to fix me, if it didn't work, then what's the point? And in that industry, they, on the memo of the check, when they pay you, they write something antagonistic, grotesque. They write, you know, something to demean you on these checks. And normally when I would deposit them, I would just do mobile deposit, ATM, anything other than hand it to a person, because I didn't want that person to know what I had done because I was ashamed of it. And at the same time, in that industry, you don't even go by your real name, you go by a pseudonym. You exchange your name for a fake name because there's a level of shame, so you want to disassociate yourself from it, and they actually give that to you so you're not attached to the thing that you do, so that there's some level of separation. But that's just another level, another tactic of manipulation. Because if I can get you to do something that's not really you, then maybe you'll agree to do more and more and more until it becomes who you are, and that's just who you do, just what you do. And I'm in this place, and I'm, you know, my anxiety is amplified, my depression is deepened, and I can't do it anymore, and I'm just done. And I walk into this bank, and I slide this check across the counter, and I hadn't heard my name in over a year, and I was just so done with myself because I'd removed myself from like my fraternity brothers from college. They were saying, "Dude, I love you. Why are you living like this? You're better than this. You're worth more than this." I pushed them away. My family reaching out to me, "Joshua, what are you doing? Your life is more valuable than this. You're worth more than this. What are you doing with your life?" I pushed them away. Because that's the beauty of accountability. If someone in my life says, "Hey, you're acting in a way that's out of character," I've got two choices. I either say you're right, I do some introspection, and I'm saying, what's going on with me? And I change it, or I say, hey, don't tell me what to do. And I push them away. And I believe the lie that I can fix myself. Or I ignore the person that loves me enough to tell me the truth. Because we need those people in our lives. And so here I am. No one at this point in my life really knew me. And I'm sitting there in front of this bank teller, and I slide her a check that says what I did, and I'm waiting on her to shake her head or just look disgusted at me because I feel disgusted. And she looks me in the eyes and says, Joshua, are you okay? Joshua, how can I help you? And I was shaking, tears streaming down my face, sweating, moments from ending my life. And it wasn't a customer service interaction. She cared enough about the person standing in front of her, and I believe that she was prompted by the Spirit to ask me, what's going on in your life? How can I help you? And just the hearing of my name, because I hadn't heard it in so long, it led to me running and calling my mom, and my mom said the thing that I was afraid that she wouldn't. I love you. I'm not mad at you. I wish you would have called me. I love you. Please come home. So I did, and while I left that industry, what I brought to where I moved, so I moved from California to North Carolina, but what I brought with me was the wounds of living that way, the amplified wounds of already believing that I wasn't worth very much. And what I tried to do then was I tried to put enough good dirt on my bad dirt so I didn't feel dirty. Right, I tried to do enough good things so I didn't feel bad about the bad things that I had done. And if I'm honest, I tried to do enough good things so I didn't look as bad because of the bad things I've done, because I was more worried about what people thought about me than what I thought about me, because I didn't think much about me. And I started working at a gym, same mentality. Well, if I get enough certifications and accreditations and build a name of myself and do a great job and become a great trainer, I'll be someone who contributes to the community and people will look up to me and I'll help people and I'll feel good about myself because I'm doing a good thing. And while I was doing a good thing, at night, when I laid down my head on the pillow, I still believed I was the same person. And then about 2 years of this, in walks this girl, and I asked her on a date, and she shot me down, and I fell in love immediately. Rejection, yes. And I continued asking her out, and she said no to dinner, she said no to lunch, but she eventually said yes to me going running with her. And we met for a run, and I got there early, and I had my fit just right, and I was excited, and I started thinking, I was like, man, what am I going to do when she finds out who I am? This girl's amazing, like, so pretty, And I was like, when she finds out who I am, she's not going to want anything to do with me. And I almost like feel like I heard my mom's voice in my head. It was like, don't you lie to that girl. Don't you hurt that girl. Don't you do it. You know? And when she got there, I was like, hey, I got something to tell you. And I sat there for what seemed like a lifetime, and I told her every bad thing I've ever done. I was like, hey, here's a 5-minute monologue of how bad I am. And she was, you know, visibly hurt by what I was saying. And she asked the question, well, are you doing those things now? I said, no, it's been about 2 years since I've done anything like that. And then she started, I could see she was processing and almost like building up courage. And I thought she was either going to like slap me or I didn't know what was happening. But I was definitely expecting the worst. And then she got really serious. She said, "You're not defined by the worst thing you've ever done. And you're not defined by the greatest thing you'll ever do. There's a God that exists outside of time, space, and matter, and He created everything, including me and you. He determines who you are. Do you know God?" And I said, "Maybe." And if I'm honest, I thought so little of myself. What I would do is every time I had a personal interaction with someone, I call it the first date mask, where I don't know who I am, so I'm just going to try to become whoever I want, whoever I think you want me to be, so that you'll like me, because I didn't think I had anything to offer. So I was like, okay, I guess you want me to be a Christian, and I was like, maybe. I believe that God is real and He created everything, sure. So, yeah. And she's like, "Well, I've been following Jesus since I was in seventh grade. And my whole family are followers of Jesus. And I'm not perfect by any means. But the relationship that I have with Him is the foundation of my life. And He's the most important thing in my life. So do you like tacos?" I was like, "What?" Like, this girl's crazy. I was like, "What are you talking about? I was like, didn't you hear anything I just said?" But she was still interested in me. She still wanted to ask me questions. What kind of food did I like? What was my family like? Or my hopes, dreams? If I'm honest, I didn't really have any. But we walked and talked. And then at the end of that walk, I left, and then we text all week. And then on Saturday morning, she said she wanted to invite me to church that night. And she invited me to church. And when I was walking into church, I thought, well, I'm not sure if I want to be here, but I'm certainly going to follow this girl wherever she's going. And I get there, and there's this like giant wooden plaque on the wall, and it says, "We want to love people where they are and encourage them to grow in their relationship with Jesus Christ." And I was like, "Jesus sounds cool, but you don't know my story. There's no way that I could walk into a place like this and be welcomed and love me. No chance." And I want to almost, the way that, a good way to understand the very complex book of Revelation is John is letting you into windows in which he's seeing something. And what I want to do is give you a window into the sermon that I heard. So it's 2 Samuel chapter 9. And just to give you a little context about what's going on here, so there's three players in this scenario. So you got David, King David, Ziba, who was a servant of Saul, and then you have Mephibosheth, and kind of set the tone. So at this point, David had been king, and this is almost like the pinnacle of his kingship. He's, you know, really like settled in, and things are going well, and he'd recently rebuilt the temple, and things are good. And he had this relationship with Jonathan, and Jonathan was the son of Saul, and Saul had been stripped from the kingdom. So Saul was king, and then Saul sinned against God, and God stripped the kingdom away from him and anointed and chose David as king. And then a little bit further in the story, so Jonathan and Saul are in battle and they die. And historically, if there were anyone remaining of a previous kingdom, anyone in a previous family that was part of a kingdom, and then there was a new king, anyone in that previous kingdom was hunted down and killed because they could potentially, you know, lead a revolt and try to take over this kingdom. And historically, that's the way it had been done. If there was anyone that opposed the kingdom, they were killed. And even to the point where when Jonathan and Saul died, Mephibosheth was 5 years old. So four chapters earlier in 2 Samuel 5, this nurse that was in the home picks Mephibosheth up and starts running with him because she knew what that meant, because he was in line to be killed. So she was running with him and drops him, and he ends up lame in both feet. And so all of this has happened, and now this is where we are in the story. So David's thinking, okay, I've restored the temple, and I've done something kind for God, and now I'm looking to show the loving kindness to people. And he even made this promise to Jonathan. So Jonathan and David were great friends. And Saul, his father, was even trying to kill David at times. And Jonathan said that he would tell David if there was anything that he was trying to, you know, plot against him, he would tell him. He would tell David. He's like, if my dad is doing something crazy and he's coming after you, I'm going to let you know. And Jonathan asks David, hey, I see everything's going on. I see that you've been chosen to be king. And they made this covenant that David would show the loving kindness of God to Jonathan and continue to show this loving kindness to his family. And now David's remembering this promise in this moment. So verse 1, 2 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1, David asks, is there anyone remaining from the family of Saul that I can show kindness to for Jonathan's sake? There was a servant of Saul's family named Ziba. They summoned him to David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? I am your servant, he replied. So the king asked, is there anyone left of Saul's family that I can show the kindness of God to? Ziba said to the king, there is still Jonathan's son who was injured in both feet. The king asked him, where is he? Ziba answered the king, you'll find him in Lo Debar, which means place of no pasture. So he was in this desert wasteland in Palestine. He said, is there anyone left? And then he's telling them he's in Lo Debar, at the house of Machir, son of Amel. So King David had him brought from the house of Machir, son of Amel, in Lo Debar. And now Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David, fell face down, and paid homage. David said, Mephibosheth, I am your servant. He replied. Mephibosheth was scared. He was terrified because history said that he deserved death. So he's like, okay, today's the day. I've been discovered. I was hiding, but I was expecting what was coming to me. Because history pointed that my story was going to equate to death. He was ready. And then David says this, don't be afraid, David says to him, since I intend to show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan, I will restore to you all your grandfather Saul's fields, and you will always eat meals at my table. That's a beautiful picture of grace. Grace is unmerited favor that you do not deserve. Mercy is the withholding of what you do deserve. And we see this beautiful picture of David showing the loving kindness of God to him. He's inviting him to his table. And he's even restoring the land of his grandfather Saul. This was the promised land. So as he was restoring the promised land to Mephibosheth, what he was saying is, you're part of this kingdom. You're chosen. You're no longer set apart. You're not who you thought you were. Not because of what you've done, but because of what someone else has done on your behalf. This beautiful picture of grace. And Mephibosheth responded like this, and this is what I really want to lean into. Mephibosheth paid homage, and he said, "What is your servant that you take an interest in? A dead dog like me." And when I had heard the gospel, I'd heard it to the extent where I had believed, okay, there's sufficient evidence that Jesus was a real person that really walked the earth, that really died on the cross, that really rose on the third day. And I heard Romans 10:9. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and you believe in your heart that He rose on the third day, you will be saved. I'm hearing this. And I'm like, don't you know who I am? A dead dog like me? My own father didn't want me. This doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. And then I heard Hebrews 12:2. Hebrews 12:2 says this, "Keeping our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, for the joy that lay before Him, He endured the cross, despising the shame. He sat down at the right hand of God, at the right hand of the throne of God." Where there's joy, there's love. And all of a sudden, I started wrestling with something. I understood that, okay, so I'm broken. I'm like really broken. Like you don't get it. Like I'm really broken. And then what I needed to hear was, hey, Romans 3:23 says that we've all sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So who's guilty? Who's guilty? Everybody. And then Romans 6:23 says the wages of sin is what? Death. So we're all guilty and we're all deserving of death. So we're all on the same playing field. So it's like, I'm still wrestling with this. I'm like, okay, like my sins don't disqualify me more from God. I don't understand. And there's this bridge that I need to get to God because God's perfect, but I need a perfect bridge. Because, wow. We can't reconcile ourselves to a holy and perfect God. But see, God loved us so much that He sent His Son into this world, born of a virgin, and He lived a perfect life. He faced temptation but never sinned. And what we're celebrating this weekend, that He went to the cross with joy set before Him, He endured the cross. He was beaten beyond recognition. And He did it with joy in His heart. He didn't stay dead. On the third day He rose. And He's seated on the right hand of God. And that means something. But I'm like, does it mean something for me? But then He said it again. It was with joy set before Him that He endured the cross. And what I started to understand was that He was perfect, yes. So He was obedient to the Father, yes. There was love in His heart for you and for me. God loved me. God loves you. And He knows the worst of you. whatever you've done, He already knows. And you know what His response is? Joy set before Him as He died for you. That's how much He loves you. He loves you so much, and He proved it. That made its way into my bones, into my heart, into my spirit. I fell to my face. I gave my life to Jesus. Yes, Lord. I gave my life to Jesus, and I let go of the shame and guilt and pain and feeling like I wasn't good enough. And I want to just say something so that you hear it loud and clear. If you are in a relationship with Jesus, shame has no place in your life. If you walked in this room with an addiction to pornography, shame has no place in your life. If you're struggling with anger, if you've done something that you shouldn't have done, if something was done to you and you feel shame, is not. And I pray if you walked in this room with shame, that you walk out of it lighter than anyone. Jesus. Therefore, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. No condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Jesus defeated hell, death, shame, and the grave. He did that for you. But then I'm in the, okay, now what? Now what do I do with my life? What do I do? What does Mephibosheth do with the rest of his life? Access to something I never person. What? How do I understand what love is? And I had to educate myself on what love is so that I could reject what love is. Is love about the teller, thinking about the way that spoke trained to identify fraudulent currency, right? So a counterfeit dollar bill. Like cash is so irrelevant that this is only going to work for so much longer, but when you're trained to identify fraudulent or counterfeit dollar bills, you don't study what is fake. The look, the feel, everything, and they become really familiar with what is real. And if you become very familiar with what is real, this 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 7 says, love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy, boast. It is not does not keep a record of wrongs. Love finds no joy in unrighteousness, but rejoices in the things and bears all things. Isn't that beautiful? That allows you to identify and see selfish. What is lust requires sacrifice. Completely different. Pornography, polar opposite depiction of reality. There's broken people who are paid to do. There's looks real, telling them that their actor is good as what they can do. The only yes that they can say yes to is selling themselves for sex. Because when you disqualify yourself from so many things, the no becomes irrelevant to the point yes to. So these are the type of people who are saying yes to that. And then there's this product. There's this experiment. Where he created these artificial butterflies. He studied one species of butterflies. This created a more vibrant fly and better. Put it out into nature. Then the male butterflies tried to mate with this fictitious variation of a butterfly, and then the males started fighting among each other, and all of a sudden they started dying off because they had an appetite for something that wasn't real. They could see it, they could touch it, but they couldn't obtain it. In the same way, pornography is this fictitious variation of sex. And if you believe that is real and you try to pursue it, what it's going to cause is destruction in our world. and makes more money than the NBA, Major League Baseball, and the NFL all combined. 33% of all the data transferred on the internet on a daily basis is pornography. Average age of exposure used to be 11, is trending towards 8 years old. 94% of pornography depicts violence. And then I speak with young adults so often, and I'm hearing people stepping into marriages and they're unsatisfied and they're struggling to be intimate because they've developed this appetite for what they think sex is, and they bring this presupposition of what they think sex is into this marriage, and they're unsatisfied because their spouse is not living up to their expectations, but their expectations was built on a figment of their imagination. It was not real. Satan always counterfeits what God creates. In Exodus 32, we see Moses was up on the mountain getting the Ten Commandments, and Aaron and his misfits were down there, and they were creating this golden animal, and they worshiped this animal, and they even called this animal Elohim, or Yahweh. They were calling this animal that they had created God, and they were worshiping it. You see, when you create a God in your image, it's not God at all. And that's been Satan's game plan since day one. Did God really say? Did God really say this? Did God really say that sex is just for marriage? Is this really bad for me? Is this really against God's will? Because what about my feelings? What about what I deserve? What we deserve is death. But we get life. And the abundant life that Jesus offers is on the other side of obedience and discipline. The dissatisfaction and the mental health problems and the depression and the anxiety and the frustration and the shame that's attached to everything that's associated with that behavior, that is Satan's plan for your life. But Jesus died to set you free from that. And the way that you step into the freedom that you have access to is to understanding that you have freedom from and freedom for. You're not just free from sin. You're free for a good work. You're carriers of this word of reconciliation. You're called to be ambassadors. You're called to be messengers. There's a plan and a purpose for your life. But if you don't step into it, you're going to feel dissatisfied because you're not doing the very thing that God created you to do. And Satan will use any and everything he can to distract you from that. So how do we get back on course? Well, you have to remember who you are. Because in Christ, you are a daughter of the King. In Christ, you are a son of the King. That changes everything. Satan wants to kill, steal, and destroy every promise God has ever made to you. And while he can't rob you of those promises, he can most certainly distract you and get you to believe lies. He is the father of lies. So who is Jesus? We see this weekend where we celebrate Easter, Jesus clearly claimed to be God. Go John 1, where he said, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word, the Logos, talking about Jesus. Mark 14:62, they're asking, are you the King of the Jews? Are you the Messiah? Who are you claiming to be? He says, I am. I am the I am from Exodus. I'm the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven from Daniel 7. I am God. Yes. And they crucified him. But he didn't stay dead. Because he didn't stay dead. He solidified who he claimed to be, the Son of God, the Messiah, the one who takes away the sins of the world. And if you put your faith in him, you're forgiven. You're made new. It's a gift. It's easy to forget who you are. And if you want healing from something, it's going to cost you something. Because in the same way that Jesus came to lay down his life for you, a reasonable response is to lay down your life for him. I love these two examples as I come to a close. There was, well, three examples. But in Mark 2, we see Jesus' friends. We see Jesus in the scenario, and then these friends bring a paralytic man. They want to hear the teachings of Jesus. They want his friend to be in the presence of Jesus. And they will do anything to get their friend into the presence of Jesus, because they believe if they invite their friend and they bring him into the presence of Jesus, Jesus will change his situation. And they tore this roof apart and they lowered him down to Jesus. And when they did, we see the situation where, I'll just read it to you. So, since they were not able to bring him to Jesus because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him. And after digging it, they lowered the mat which the paralytic was lying. Seeing their faith, Jesus told the paralytic, "Son, your sins are forgiven." And then in Mark 5, there was this woman that she was bleeding for years and years and years, and she just thought, if I get close enough to Jesus, if I just touch his garment, if I just get close enough to the person of Jesus, I have so much faith in him that I believe he will change my situation. And he does. Mark 5 says this: the woman, with fear and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, knowing that she had been made well because she touched the garment of Jesus, came and fell down before him, and he told him the whole truth. And Jesus says to her, "Daughter," he said to her, "your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." See, when you understand what it means to be a son or to be a daughter, it changes your situation. There's healing that's available to you. You don't have to walk out what you walked in here carrying. Whether it's anxiety, whether it's addiction, whether it's frustration or unforgiveness, you don't have to walk out of here what you walked in here with. Because Jesus loves you as you are, but he loves you enough to not leave you as you are. He loves you enough to change your situation. And I just want to read this. So Galatians 4:4-7 says this: "When the time comes to completion, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, so that we might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God sent the spirit of his son into our hearts, crying, 'Abba, Father.' So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then God has made you an heir." Yes, Lord. And what I love about this is, if you dig into what does it mean regarding the context of sonship in Roman culture. So it was a big deal, and this is why this language was used. This is why adoption is a big deal. And here's just an overarching truth. Everyone is made in the image of God. But not everyone are sons and daughters of God. That comes at a price. The blood of Jesus gives you access to the family of God. See, sonship is a big deal. In ancient Rome, adoption had a powerful meaning. When a child was born biologically, the parents had the option of disowning the child for a variety of reasons. The relationship, therefore, was not necessarily desired by the parent, nor was it permanent. Not so, however, if a son was or a daughter was adopted. In Rome, adopting a child meant that child was freely chosen by the parents and desired by the parents. You are chosen. You are desired. He died for you. That child would be a permanent part of the family. Parents could not disown a child they adopted. An adopted child received a new identity, and any prior commitments, responsibilities, and debts were erased. New rights and new responsibilities were taken on. Also in ancient Rome, the concept of inheritance was part of life, not something that began at death. Being adopted made someone an heir to their father, joint sharers in all their possessions, and fully united to him. So eternity doesn't start when you die. Eternity starts when you choose to follow Jesus. So I want you to begin to think about something. Because we all walked in here carrying something. And maybe you have a story that maybe it's not exactly like mine, but there's something that you can see in your life. Maybe there's a wound from someone that should have been there for you. Maybe there was a death. Maybe someone was supposed to protect you and they didn't. Maybe you thought someone was your protector and they hurt you. Maybe someone you trusted let you down. Maybe you were the person that hurt someone, and you need to forgive yourself, and you need to extend forgiveness. Maybe there's shame associated with your past. Regardless of those things, what's true about me today is I used to have a wound, but now it's a scar. And that scar tells a story. And it doesn't point to my fatherlessness or pornography. It points to the only person that can heal. His name is Jesus. And as I close, I wanted to invite you into this story. That there's this moment where if you don't feel like you've blown it, you have. we've all blown it. And in John 21, we see this story where Peter has blown it. So, you know, just to give a quick overarching story of Peter, Peter thought his identity was what he did instead of who God called him to be. He thought he was a fisherman. Jesus said, "No, you're a fisher of men." And then Jesus asked Peter, who do you say that I am? And he said, "You're the Messiah." And then Peter was the OG rock. So Peter was the rock before the rock was the rock. And then 3 verses later, he was Satan. So quickly we can fall. And then so Peter has this charisma, this deep faith. Because, I mean, Peter even had the courage to step out on water. It was Peter's idea. He saw Jesus out on the water and he said, "Jesus, tell me to step out of the boat onto water and to come to you." It was Peter's idea. So to have that level of supernatural courage, that's attached to supernatural faith. So Peter knew Jesus. He saw him do the miraculous. And he also said, "I would never deny you. I would never do that. I would never deny you," yet he did. And how many times have you said that you would never do that thing again? Or you would never do that? I know I've been there. And you keep going back over and over and over again. So Peter does the thing that he said he would never do. He did it not once, not twice, but 3 times. Denied Jesus. Jesus goes to the cross and he dies. And the disciples run for their lives. They're scared. And on the third day, Jesus rose. And sometime later, we see this beautiful interaction on the beach where Jesus is making breakfast. And there's this Greek word that means burning coals, and it's twice in the New Testament, and the sense of smell is so interconnected to your memory. It's like there's certain things about maybe your parents or sports, or there's things that when you smell something, you're in that moment. And this Greek word anthrakeia that means burning coals, it shows up twice. It shows up the first time that Peter denied Jesus. Jesus was asked, aren't you a follower of Jesus? Aren't you one of the disciples? No, not me. Then all of a sudden, he's at the same smell and these burning coals, and Jesus asked him a question. Do you love me? Yeah. Yes, I love you. He asked him again, do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? And he's frustrated. He says, yes, a third time. And what I love about the Bible is if you dig deep into it, it reveals something so beautiful. And in Greek, there's several words for love. And Jesus used the word agape. Do you agape me? Peter, do you agape me? That means the totality of love. This is God's love for his people. Do you love me like that? Peter couldn't commit to that. He says, I phileo you. It's a brotherly love. I love you, but I can't commit to that because I failed you. I blew it. And Jesus asked him again, do you agape me? I phileo you. And then the third time, Jesus says, well, do you phileo me? Peter was frustrated, but he said, yeah. He says, go feed my sheep. Allow my love for you to meet you where you really are. And remind yourself who I called you to be. Because just like Mephibosheth is in front of the grace that David is bestowing upon him, and he couldn't even receive it because he had disqualified himself. What have you disqualified yourself from? What have you believed that you're not good enough for? What lie have you believed about yourself? Have you believed it's always going to be this way? This is just who I am. This is just what I'm going to do. Are you ready to lay something down? Because Jesus has so much more for you. Understand, he loves you. Let his love give you courage. Because that love in Peter's life, that's what we see in Acts 3. Peter saying, you denied Jesus and he was crucified. Your sin did that, and so did mine. And what that had to look like in my life was that about 3.5 years ago, I was laying in bed, and I got woke up in the middle of the night, and I felt convicted to pray, and I started to pray, but I was being lazy, so I was laying on my back, and I was praying, and God asked me a question that changed my life. He said, do you fear me? And he's not talking about, am I afraid of you? Like, do you revere me? Do you honor me? Do you trust me? When we see things like John 14:15, if you obey my commandments, if you love me, you obey my commandments. it's easy to see the authoritative voice of God saying, if you love me, you'll do what I say. But that's us putting an earthly pretense on a godly father. When God is saying that is, if you trust me, I've got a better way. So I got out of bed. I was like, God, what do you want from me? And I was searching for purpose in my life, and I was searching for meaning, and I was searching for the ability to forgive my dad. And I was looking like, God, what do you want me to do? I want to do all these things for you. I want to find purpose. I want to find a plan for my life. I want to do all these things. What do I need to do? Where can I find you? What do I need to do? How hard do I need to work? What church do I need to be at to do this? How many, all the works. What do I need to do? What I understand, this is where purpose is found. This is where healing is found. When I surrendered to God, what I discovered was that I was wrestling with this thought of, well, if my dad would have been there, I wouldn't have done that stuff. If my dad would have been there, my life would have been easier. If he would have been there, I wouldn't have done that stuff. I wouldn't have had the life that I had. It's his fault. And while my trauma and my pain is real, and whatever happened to you is real, and those things really cause pain and they really hurt, what they don't do is force your hand. I had to take ownership for my sin. And I was holding on to extending forgiveness to my dad because I thought, well, if I forgive him, what if the relationship doesn't look like what I think it should? I had to realize I'm not God. Your situation might not look like what you think it should look like, but there's a God that is good, and he has good things for his children. You can trust him. And that night I laid down my life in a way where I surrendered to God, and I forgave my father, and I repented of my sin truly. Stood up different. Because sometimes we get in this, it's easy to confess the 99% of our sin and our struggle. It's easy to go forward and confess the things that everyone else is struggling with. Yeah, me too, me too, me too. But what's the 1%? What's the thing that you just can't let go of because it hurts too bad? Or if anyone knew this about me, then they would judge me, or I would lose my position, or this person wouldn't like me, or this is too bad, it's too dirty, it's too much, it hurts too much. I could never say this, I could never let this go. That's exactly what Satan wants you to do. He wants to keep you trapped where you are, but I promise you, the fear that you feel when you think those thoughts, if you open up your hands and surrender, there's healing. Because what is true, you will only find the amount of freedom as you're willing to be honest. You're only as free as you're honest. You're only going to be as healed as you're willing to be honest. And your Father is saying, come to me. My grace is more than enough.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you would like to know more about us, visit our Instagram at UGABCM or visit us on our website at UGABCM.org. We hope you enjoyed, and we'll see you next time.